Okay, let's unpack this. We are taking a deep dive into humanity's most complex, most persistent accomplishment outside of Earth atmosphere, the space station. I mean, these are so much more than just orbital laboratories. They're the true enduring outposts on the orbital frontier. They really define what it means for humans to live permanently off-world.
Precisely. And when we talk about a space station, we're defining it as a habitable artificial satellite. Basically, a spacecraft designed specifically to remain in orbit and host humans for extended, sometimes indefinite, periods.
And the purpose for them is just, it's changed so much over the
Oh,
decade.
absolutely. They've served as research facilities, and they once functioned as military observation posts, and now increasingly they're acting as commercial enterprises.
What's truly remarkable to me is not just what they are, but for how long they've been continuously occupied.
Right.
If you look back, space stations have hosted the only continuous human presence in space since 1987. That's when the Soviets transitioned from the Salyut series to the game-changing Mir.
And it gets even more stunning. We've maintained uninterrupted human occupation in orbit since the very first resident crew arrived at the International Space Station, the ISS, back in November of 2000. Think about that. Over 2 decades of constant orbital residency, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just a few hundred miles above our heads. It's an unprecedented commitment.
It truly is. And the current state of affairs, it just shows how much this tech has matured. We're not just talking about one station anymore.
Not at all. Right now, as we speak, there are two fully operational and continuously occupied stations up there.
You have the massive international cooperative that is the ISS.
And you have China's growing independent Tiangong space station, which has been consistently crewed since mid-2022.
That dual presence really says something, doesn't it?
It really emphasizes the proliferation of this capability, and we just keep setting new records for sheer density in orbit. The current record for the most people on space stations at the same time is a staggering 17 individuals.
17 people. 17. That was 11 on the ISS and 6 on the TSS. First reached on May 30th, 2023.
17 people at once. That's like a small village, or at least a very, very packed lab complex, all living and working up there. I mean, doesn't that raise huge new logistical challenges?
It absolutely does, and it speaks volumes about the maturity of the technology and also the coordination needed. But focusing on the engineering, that scale is only possible because of their architecture.
They're modular.
Inherently modular, they rely so heavily on these strategically placed docking ports.
And those ports are the essential connectors, right? They let new modules attach, but most critically, they're for the crew for supplies.
Exactly. It means these stations are always works in progress, always capable of being upgraded, and while they stay in their orbit, they don't just sit still.
Right, because of that faint drag from the upper atmosphere.
That's it. It's incredibly tenuous, but it constantly pulls them down. We call it orbital decay.
Orbital decay, and it sounds so dramatic, but it's more of a constant subtle friction. It is. It's basically friction from atmospheric molecules hitting the station's huge structure. And over time, that friction makes the station lose velocity and slowly spiral inward toward
So
Earth.
how do they fight it?
To counteract that, the stations have dedicated thrusters just for station keeping. These are just minor, precise adjustments to maintain altitude. But that consumption of fuel is constant.
Which is why those resupply missions are mandatory.
Mandatory. If you stop doing station keeping, you lose the station. That's actually what happened to Salyut-1.
So we have to start at the beginning, long before any of this was real. The idea of an orbital habitat is surprisingly old.
It is. The very first concept appeared in fiction. We trace it back to Edward Everett Hale's serial from 1868 called The Brick Moon.
The brick moon. I love
It
that.
was imagined as this 61-meter sphere of bricks, meant to be a navigational beacon, but it was accidentally launched into orbit with people still inside. The first fictional artificial satellite.
But the science-based ideas came a lot later. We're talking Tsiolkovsky and Hermann Oberth in the early 20th century. They shifted it from fantasy to physics.
They did. But then Potashnik took those physics concepts and gave us the first real blueprint.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because this idea still drives our planning for deep space today. Hermann Potashnik, in 1929, he published The Problem of Space Travel. And in it, he didn't just describe a structure, he designed the iconic rotating wheel space station. It was the first proposal to use rotation specifically to generate artificial gravity.
And Potashnik's insight was just profound. He understood that true long-duration habitation couldn't happen in zero G without catastrophic health consequences.
So artificial gravity was the solution.
It would solve the immense biological challenges. And this specific rotating design, it became iconic. Wernher von Braun referenced it in 1951. But despite being recognized as necessary, the engineering challenge was just too immense. No one even started building one in the 20th century.
So we are still fighting Potashenko's 1929 problem today.
We really are.
So before we could build anything, we first had to master the orbital dance, the rendezvous and docking.
Yes, and the Gemini program was really the dress rehearsal for that. It achieved the first space rendezvous with Gemini 6 and 7 in 1965.
Proving you could meet another object in space.
Exactly. Then Neil Armstrong performed the first ever space docking with an unmanned Agena vehicle on Gemini 8 in 1966. These were just crucial steps.
And the Soviets were innovating at the same time.
They were. In 1967, they achieved the first automatic docking with Cosmos 186 and 188. Then came a really critical step. Soyuz 4 and 5 in 1969 performed the first docked crew transfer.
But they had to do a spacewalk to get from one craft to the other, right?
They did. It demonstrated you could exchange personnel, but it was risky. Apollo 9 followed soon after, the first internal transfer between two docked ships. Much safer, much faster.
And all of that laid the foundation for the first generation of stations, the monolithic era.
A time defined by speed and single launch structures. The Soviet Union launched the world's first space station, Salyut 1, in 1971. A true triumph of engineering.
But that triumph was quickly overshadowed by tragedy.
Unfortunately, yes. The first crew from Soyuz 11 spent 23 days aboard, setting new duration records. But during re-entry, a pressure equalization valve malfunctioned, and the crew perished.
It cast such a long shadow.
It did. It highlighted the extreme dangers of this early technology.
So Salyut 1 and its American counterpart, Skylab, they really define this monolithic design philosophy.
Absolutely. Monolithic stations were built and launched in a single, fully assembled piece. And crucially, they launched with basically all their supplies, air, fuel, experiments for the entire mission.
So once those were used up?
The station was abandoned. It was eventually deorbited. They were essentially single-use orbital outposts.
Skylab is a perfect example of the challenges there. I mean, it's suffered catastrophic damage during its launch.
It almost made it unusable. Astronauts had to be sent up for this incredibly dramatic repair mission in 1973.
The first major in-space repair effort.
It was. They had to deploy a temporary sunshade to replace lost thermal shielding and free a stuck solar array. The fact that the entire mission hinged on that kind of complex manual repair just underscored the weakness of the monolithic design.
If something critical broke or ran out, you couldn't easily fix it.
Exactly.
Right.
The station's life was just rigidly predetermined by that single launch.
I find the dual nature of those early Soviet efforts fascinating. They were all called Salyut, but they weren't all scientific.
They weren't. The Soviet efforts strategically included both civilian research stations, like Salyut 1 and 4, and highly classified military ones.
The Almaz program.
Yes, the Almaz program. But they were launched under the Salyut name for political cover. Salyut 2, 3, and 5 were actually Almaz spy stations.
So what does military use even mean for a space station?
Primarily reconnaissance and observation. Almaz stations had high-resolution cameras, basically huge telescopes, and in some cases even defensive weaponry. Salyut 5, which orbited from 76 to 77, holds the distinction as the last confirmed crewed military-use space station. After that, the focus really shifted toward research and international collaboration.
The limitations of the monolithic design were pretty obvious. So what was the innovation that let missions extend beyond just a few months?
That takes us to the transitional generation. Salyut 6 and Salyut 7. And the critical innovation was incorporating two docking ports.
Two ports. It sounds so simple, but the implications were revolutionary.
It solved two massive operational bottlenecks. First, crew exchange. The Soyuz ferry craft had a strict 90-day orbital limit.
So with one port, the crew had to leave before that limit.
Right. But two ports allowed a fresh crew to arrive in a new Soyuz and swap out the aging craft before its time ran out. This was the key to achieving continuous crewing.
That's the first real step toward permanent habitation. You can always bring up fresh hands and a new lifeboat.
Exactly. But the second function was arguably even more crucial for duration. It allowed specialized logistical craft, the automated Progress supply vehicles, to dock.
Ah, so they could bring up fuel, air filters, food.
Everything. Propellant for station keeping, water, consumables. The Progress vehicles didn't just bring food. They turned a short-term lab into a truly permanent habitat.
As long as the supply lines kept flowing.
That's the core insight. The later Salyuts, especially Salyut 7, really served as a proof of concept for the modular future, making them a clear transition between the monolithic past and the modular revolution to come.
So the true birth of modularity, where the concept was baked in from the very start, that came with the Soviet, then Russian, Station Mir.
Yes. Launched in 1986, it marked a fundamental shift in design philosophy that's still the global standard today.
And Mir launched as just a small core unit, right? Mm-hmm. Essentially a technological backbone.
That's it. And then over the next decade, they added specialized pieces for everything from material science to astrophysics, mm-hmm. that is modular design in orbit. You launch a manageable core, and then you add modules piece by piece.
Which has massive advantages. Operationally, you get more flexibility. If one module has a problem, you can often isolate it. But economically, the advantage seems profound. You don't need a single monstrously powerful rocket to throw everything up at once.
Exactly. The shift to modularity was an economic and political necessity just as much as a technological one. It allowed for sustained growth. And Mir operated for 15 years until 2001.
And its legacy includes that enduring crew duration record for a single spaceflight. Valeria Polyakov's incredible 437.75 days.
An astonishing feat of human endurance. He was a physician, and his mission focused heavily on the medical effects of long-duration spaceflight. The fact that this record was set on Mir just underscores its role as the initial proving ground for deep space residency.
Then came the ISS, the ultimate expression of modularity. But when you look at how it was built, it reveals this fascinating hybrid with two very distinct construction philosophies.
Indeed. The ISS is divided into the Russian Orbital Segment, or ROS, and the U.S. Orbital Segment, USOS, and they were assembled using fundamentally different approaches.
Let's start with the Russian approach, the ROS.
The ROS operated under an autonomous assembly philosophy, a direct evolution from Mir. Russian modules launched on Proton rockets, flew themselves to orbit, and docked themselves automatically.
So no human intervention needed for the docking?
None. It connected power, data, propellants, all on its own. It's like building with high-tech Legos that have their own jetpacks.
That's a great analogy.
And it meant significant assembly could happen before the first crew even arrived. It also means the modules are inherently more flexible. They can theoretically be reconfigured or even removed.
In sharp contrast, you have the USOS, which used the shuttle EVA assembly philosophy.
Absolutely. The main US modules were designed to fit inside the space shuttle's payload bay. Once delivered, they required crews to perform extensive spacewalks, EVAs, to physically attach them and manually connect everything.
So that sounds less like Legos and more like a huge piece of industrial equipment that needs astronauts to physically bolt and wire every single component.
That's precisely the difference. The USOS philosophy resulted in an integrated block. It's a rigid structure, not designed for easy disassembly. When the ISS mission ends, the USOS section has to be deorbited as one massive piece.
While the ISS dominates, we can't overlook the other major player right now, China's Tiangong program.
A very methodical, step-by-step approach. They began with precursors. Tiangong 1, launched in 2011, was their first orbital lab. Its main job was just validating docking technology.
And they followed that up with Tiangong 2 in 2016.
Another crucial lab used to test life support and resupply systems. It was a very clear, patient path toward a permanent station.
Which brings us to the current Tiangong Space Station, or TSS.
A major statement of independent national capability. The core module launched in April 2021, and it was officially completed in November 2022.
And its orbit is interesting. It's in LEO, like the ISS, but it has a very specific inclination.
It does. It maintains an inclination of 42 to 43 degrees. And that inclination is a technical necessity with strategic implications.
What does that tell us?
Well, orbital inclination determines the northernmost and southernmost points the station passes over. And 42 degrees is dictated by the latitude of their launch sites in China. It just ensures maximum efficiency for launch gear covering their crew.
So they've optimized it for their national geography.
Exactly. It cements its role as a major permanent national outpost. And with a total capacity for 6 crew members, it's a very capable facility.
So we've seen how they're built, but surviving up there is a whole other challenge. Let's talk about the mechanics of daily life, the fight for habitability.
It is a constant battle against physics and biology. You have the immediate challenges, maintaining air, water, and food, and managing waste heat. Air and water are recycled with incredible efficiency, often up to 90%.
But the really insidious problems are the long-term biological ones, aren't they? Weightlessness and radiation.
These are responsible for significant, well-documented health problems. The lack of gravity leads to rapid muscle atrophy and bone deterioration. You also see balance disorders and a condition called SANS, which affects eyesight.
And then there's the radiation?
An elevated cancer risk from constant exposure to cosmic rays and solar flares.
And the Earth's magnetic field offers a degree of protection in LEO, doesn't it?
It does, which is a key advantage. It acts like a shield. But once you leave LEO, like the Lunar Gateway will, you lose that shield entirely.
Which is why radiation shielding is such a huge challenge for deep space travel. So what are the future solutions?
The ultimate solution ties right back to Podoznik's 1929 vision, creating artificial gravity with a rotating structure. Beyond that, you need dedicated, dense radiation shielding, which adds a lot of mass, and on-site closed-loop agricultural ecosystems.
These are all necessary steps toward making them cities in space,
where people could reside permanently and safely.
The material science on the current stations is already impressive, though. What are they made of?
Extremely durable but lightweight materials. We're talking stainless steel, titanium, high-quality aluminum alloys, and critically, multi-layered insulation like Kevlar, which acts as a ballistic shield against micrometeoroids.
And we have a great example of innovation on the ISS itself, the inflatable module.
The Bigelow Expandable Activity Module, or BEAM, a significant testbed. It was installed in 2016. The genius is in the transport volume. It was compressed for launch, weighing only 1,400 kilograms.
And then it inflated in orbit.
Expanded to 16 cubic meters. It's a game changer for reducing launch costs and maximizing living space.
And it was only supposed to last for 2 years, right?
That was the plan, just a tech demo.
No.
But it performed so well that it was still being used for storage as of August 2022, proving the durability of the concept.
None of this orbital existence is possible without a massive network of orbital traffic, the resupply lines.
The ISS alone has been supported by an incredibly diverse array of spacecraft. Currently active, you have Northrop Grumman's Cygnus, Russia's Progress and Soyuz, and of course, SpaceX's Dragon 2.
And the retired workhorses deserve a mention. The European ATV, the Japanese HTV, the Space Shuttle.
The original Dragon 1. It's a testament to sustained international logistical achievement. The complexity is just astonishing.
Do you have an anecdote that captures that complexity?
There's a truly unique feat from 1986 involving the Soyuz T-15. This Soyuz launched and crewed the new Mir station, but then the crew undocked and flew 29 hours across space to the older Salyut 7 station.
No way.
They retrieved equipment and supplies from Salyut 7 and then returned to Mir in the same spacecraft.
They used a single spacecraft as a moving van between two different space stations.
Exactly. It's the only spacecraft to have ever visited two different space stations in a single flight. A serious piece of orbital maneuvering.
Beyond just keeping people alive, the core mission is research. What kind of scientific legacy are they building?
They're unparalleled scientific platforms.
Yeah.
The first 20 years at the ISS, nearly 3,000 experiments were conducted. Biology, human research, physical science.
And material science is a huge part of that. Testing how things hold up in the vacuum of space.
Absolutely. The stations provide a unique external platform to test the stability and survivability of materials vital for future spacecraft. The key modern example is the Materials International Space Station Experiment, or ASCA. That research guides every single choice of alloy and coating we launch in the future.
As we look to the next decade, we have to start with the economic reality. It costs, what, $10,000 to $25,000 per kilogram to launch anything into orbit?
That's the average. And that high barrier has traditionally kept stations as the exclusive province of massive government agencies.
But that is changing so rapidly. The discussion isn't if commercial stations will exist, but when and how many.
This pivot is fueled by two things. First, space tourism. We've seen guests pay $50 million for a week on the ISS. That's a revenue stream. But second, and most critically, the anticipated lower launch costs from reusable systems like Starship.
When the cost per kilogram drops, the business model suddenly becomes viable.
And that economic shift is leading to this new era of planned, commercially run stations.
Let's list some of them because this is the imminent next phase.
Leading the charge is Haven 1 from VAST, scheduled for 2026. This is slated to be the world's first true commercial space station.
Following quickly after that, also in 2026, we have the Life Pathfinder from Sierra Space.
A precursor to their larger concepts, featuring a massive inflatable module with 285 cubic meters of space.
And there's StarMax from Gravitics, promising up to 400 cubic meters in a single module.
To put that in perspective, that's nearly half the habitable volume of the entire ISS in one launch.
And the ultimate sign of this transition is Axiom Station. Planned for 2027, it starts life docked to the ISS.
Yes, it begins as the commercial segment, Then, when the ISS is retired, those modules will detach to become a completely free-flying commercial station. It's the ultimate handoff from government property to private operation.
And we can't forget the behemoth, Orbital Reef.
Developed by Blue Origin and Sierra Space, planned for 2027. This one is intended for 10 crew members with an enormous volume of 830 cubic meters, a major multi-purpose destination.
So these are designed from the ground up to be profitable businesses.
Not just scientific labs subsidized by taxpayers.
Exactly. Yeah. And beyond the private sector, nations are making huge moves for a post-ISS world.
Russia has announced its Russian Orbital Service Station, or ROSS, for around 2027. This will be their new independent outpost.
Then there's the Lunar Gateway, which is a whole different kind of station.
Yes. Planned for 2027, a joint project. And critically, it's not in low Earth orbit. It will be in a near rectilinear halo orbit around the moon.
And if it's outside LEO, it loses the protection of the Earth's magnetic field.
That's absolutely right. It has to solve the radiation problem immediately. It's a stepping stone that forces us to solve the physical constraints of deep space survival.
And finally, a new player, the Bharatiya Antariksha Station.
India's space agency, ISRO, plans to complete it around 2028. They've made it explicitly clear they were building their own outpost to serve their own national goals, rather than joining existing collaborations. The orbital frontier is getting decidedly crowded. This whole exploration, it just reminds us that these outposts are the architectural foundation for future exploration and maybe even permanent settlement.
We're talking about moving from a temporary, confined habitat to something closer to what we've only ever seen in fiction.
Exactly. And when we connect this to the bigger picture, the cultural impact has always been tied to those fictional concepts. O'Neill cylinders, the Stanford Torus, these vast rotating habitats.
The vision has always been permanent.
And the current explosion of commercial and national plans suggests we are rapidly moving past the ISS era toward a diversified, robust orbital economy that might actually make those grand habitats possible.
The constraints are loosening.
And the infrastructure is being laid. We're transitioning from the first hesitant footsteps of the 1970s into an established multinational orbital civilization.
So we have journeyed from the one-shot monolithic Salyuts and Skylab to the modular international labs of the ISS. And now we're on the cusp of commercially owned orbital hotels and deep space staging posts.
The complexity is being decentralized and industrialized.
So here is a final provocative thought for you, the listener, to consider. We mentioned the duration record, Valery Polyakov's 437.75 days on mirror testament human endurance in zero G. As we plan massive artificial gravity stations like VAST's concept for a 1,400 cubic meter rotating station planned for 2035, how fundamentally will the challenge of long-term human habitation change? When home is no longer a confined, weightless lab, but a true rotating city in space, what specific societal or psychological challenges will that permanent residency in an artificial ecosystem create once we move beyond the physical constraints? The future of human civilization is literally taking shape in orbit right now, moving from simply surviving in space to truly living there.